Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Eco Justice Radio acknowledges that we record the show on the traditional territory of the Tongva and all of their relatives. Welcome, I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, microplastics are everywhere. What's the risk? I will be interviewing Dr. Scott Coffin, environmental toxicologist and research scientist at California State Water Resource Control Board. Dr. Scott Coffin is a research scientist and subject matter expert for microplastics at the California State Water Resource Control Board, where he leads the agency's efforts to monitor and manage microplastics pollution in drinking water and the environment. Dr. Coffin holds a PhD in environmental toxicology from the University of California, Riverside, and has been studying plastics impacts on the environment since 2014. Today we are in for a very eye-opening discussion, an environmental and human health matter that is growing in concern, research, and solutions. Microplastics. Small, micro-sized plastic fragments are showing up in our water sources, rain, drinking water, and beverages like beer. It is in food, salt, and seafood, and recently it has been found in human breast milk, placentas, human lungs, and blood. One report indicated that blue whales are consuming 10 million pieces of microplastic particles a day. As plastic fragments, it continues to shed fiber smaller than a strand of human hair. Most of the time, we are unaware how and when this happens. Did you know that when you open a plastic cap on a bottle, you release thousands of plastic particles? But then there's also our clothing, roads, artificial turf, food packaging, tea bags, or really any plastic that comes in contact with friction, hot liquid, or hot food. The biggest human body entry point for microplastics, it's not our water, food packaging, or clothing, although all of these are still of great concern. It's the air we breathe. Plastics and their chemical additives can be toxic. Of more than 10,000 unique chemicals used in plastics, more than 2,400 are of potential concern, most of which are unregulated. So should we be worried about microplastics in the environment and in our bodies? What is the average level of human exposure? And is there enough to prove that a health risk exists? Well, our guest, Dr. Scott Coffin, has been studying plastics since 2014. He is a toxicologist and research scientist at the California State Water Resource Control Board. He joins us today to speak to the issues, how microplastics are entering our environment, what solutions are being put in place to assess risk and implement precautionary solutions, and how we might limit our own exposure. Thank you for tuning in to Eco Justice Radio and our show, Microplastics Are Everywhere. What's the risk? I am your host, Jessica Aldridge. It is my honor to welcome our guest, Dr. Scott Coffin, environmental toxicologist and research scientist at California State Water Resources Control Board. Welcome to Eco Justice Radio.
Happy to be here, Jessica.
Yeah, welcome, Scott. I am so super interested in this conversation, and I have so many people I want to share this with. As many of our listeners know, my background is waste, and so I have a special interest here. Dr. Coffin, you have a PhD in environmental toxicology. Before we get into everything and anything about microplastics, what does an environmental toxicologist do, and why is it important?
Environmental toxicologists study the interactions between humans and the environment. This can be as broadly as the pollutants that we put into our drinking water, and as complicated as global climate change and impacts to ecosystem services that can alter the ability for our planet to support life on the system, including ourselves.
In the world of environmental toxicology, where do you focus your time and energy, and why do you do that?
So since 2014, I've been focused mostly on plastic pollution, and particularly on the effects on aquatic ecosystems as well as humans more recently, thinking about many different ways that plastic can harm us, from the particles themselves to the chemicals that are intentionally added to plastics. Many people have probably heard about bisphenol A or BPA. These were banned in water bottles for babies some years ago. That's just one of tens of thousands of intentionally added chemicals to plastics that we are exposed to on a daily basis every time we use any materials that are made of plastic. And endocrine disrupting chemicals are chemicals that interfere with our very delicate endocrine system. This is the system that controls our hormones, can control our mood, our weight, our ability to reproduce, our development. And very small quantities of these chemicals that we're exposed to on a daily basis can dramatically affect the outcome of our lives, and even our children and grandchildren's lives. So this is something that's been very interesting to me scientifically, but also quite worrying to me, as a citizen of the planet.
And your thesis, your PhD, was based on microplastics, correct?
So I studied the interactions between these plastic, these endocrine disrupting chemicals, plastics, and organisms in the environment that interact with plastic. So we know, we've by this point, probably all of us have seen a photo of a sea turtle with a straw up its nose, or a seabird with a lighter inside of its gut. For toxicologists, we want to know what that's doing to the organism. What happens when plastic enters the guts of these different critters out in the environment? Are the chemicals that are added to these plastics transferring to their bodies? And if so, at what quantities should we be concerned about them? So for my PhD, I gathered plastics from the North Pacific Gyre, also known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Many of us have probably heard about this. It's a garbage patch twice the size of Texas off the coast of California. So I collected plastics from the garbage patch that had been out there for probably 5 to even 15 years. And they've been subjected to sunlight and waves and salt. And a lot of the chemicals that were originally added to those plastics might have already migrated off of the material. And they might have also, the plastic might have also picked up other harmful chemicals and microbiota out in the environment. And so I was interested to know if a seabird were to eat a lighter or something floating in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, what chemicals are being transferred to that organism? So I took these plastics, I found virgin versions of these plastics, so a lighter that had not been in the ocean that I just bought from a store, and I subjected the lighter to gut conditions that mimic the what it would look like inside the a bird, looking at low pH and surfactants and high temperature within a bird's gut to try and mimic those conditions. And I took the extracts from the bird gut leachates, and I used what's called an in vitro bioassay, which is a really fancy term for a cell culture that's been genetically engineered to emit light when the estrogen receptor is activated. And this is a really cool tool that allows us to use biology, human biology, to indicate if there is some activity going on with chemicals. And so it's a very, very sensitive receptor-based assay that I used, which let us know what types of chemicals and what potencies of endocrine disruptors are coming off of these plastics, which is really relevant for assessing risks to these species.
And we're going to talk about risk and the definition of risk in a moment. I want to define microplastics. What are they? How did they originate? Are they already these small plastics like what we're used to in facial scrubs, where it's like you can put these little things on your face and exfoliate your skin? Or is it degraded plastic? Is it all of it?
Microplastics is a very broad term that historically has not had a harmonized or unified definition. The term microplastics is relatively new. It's only been around for about 15 years or so. And the term micro typically refers to, in the science world, a micron-sized thing. And for microplastics, we're actually talking about things all the way as large as the tip of your thumb, something that's in the as small as 5 millimeters. You can see that with your naked eye. Particles as small as 1 nanometer can also be considered microplastics. And for that, the most expensive microscope in the world will not be able to visualize a 1 nanometer particle. It's smaller than DNA. And these different particles, this very large range of particles, we've been concerned about since approximately 1969. That's the first time that scientists have ever documented microplastics in the environment. They were looking for sargassum, which is a type of plankton in the Sargasso Sea, which is the Gulf of Mexico. And they were finding lots of little bits of white polystyrene that resembled sargassum. And the researchers, they started counting them and documented it in the journal Science. And the results from that study really kicked off the entire field thinking about, well, what do these small particles do? And the original hypothesis from the researchers was that these particles are picking up other chemicals that are harmful, PCBs, DDTs, things that we were quite concerned about for marine life, and hyper-concentrating those chemicals on the particles. When a fish or something ingests those particles, they may have higher exposure levels to these harmful chemicals. So that was a hypothesis back in 1969, which was really in many ways ahead of its time, as it took us about 50 years to get around to finally shedding light on whether or not microplastics really do increase exposure for PCBs and DDTs. Turns out in most cases they don't, which is a good thing. But it's an evolving science. And your question about, is this just facial scrubs? Is this that's a common misconception that microplastics are only created intentionally or in consumer products. Microplastics they can break off of anything that you use. So for instance, when you unscrew the lid of a plastic water bottle, you're releasing tens of thousands of microplastic particles. You can't see them, but it's like a little puff ball of microplastics is exploding into the air every time you unscrew the lid.
And into your water. I mean, there's the water right there.
It goes into the air. Yep, exactly. And so we're really like swimming in microplastics, figuratively and literally, because these particles, they're constantly shedding from everything that we use.
And you're a research scientist at the California State Water Resource Control Board, which is under the California EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. What is the State Water Resource Control Board? What is their role? And why is it that microplastics in water has now become a concern to them?
So the California State Water Resources Control Board is the agency in California that oversees water. And what's notable about our agency with respect to microplastics is that in 2018, we were handed a bill from the legislature that requires us to set regulations for microplastics in drinking water.
In California.
In California. No other government anywhere in the world has any requirements like this. We are the first state and actually the first government agency anywhere in the world to define microplastics legally, require monitoring, period, anywhere, and have an analytical method that we can accredit laboratories for.
Oh, that's great. Dr. Coffin, when you assess toxicity risk, you look at a combination of exposure and hazard. Exposure and hazard. Can you explain the difference between those two, exposure and hazard? I mean, aren't we all exposed to plastic? Every single, I have plastic on my headphones. I'm talking into plastic. I'm looking into plastic. I'm sitting on plastic. I mean, it's everywhere.
So the term risk to a toxicologist means something different than it does to in many other fields. And it's like you said, it is the combination of exposure and hazard. You can think of this very easily as hazard is a hazard could be a shark. Sharks are hazardous. If you are exposed to the shark, you're swimming nearby it, you are at risk. But if you're not exposed to the shark, there is no risk. Likewise, there could be sharks that are more or less hazardous. A great white shark, I would not want to be swimming nearby, whereas a nurse shark, I would have no qualms with. And so for plastic pollution, we're exposed every day. And some reports say that we're exposed to a credit card per week. Likely that's a high overestimation. It's more like a grain of salt per week. But
Of microplastics. Yeah.
But neither of those really have any meaning unless we know how much is actually harmful. And for that, we need to understand the hazard. How toxic are microplastics? Compare it to the exposure, determine the risk.
And where are we seeing the microplastics accumulating in the natural environment, and what's being done about that? I mean, you were talking about the state law recently for the state of California.
In the environment, we see a lot of accumulation in agricultural farms and places that we apply biosolids. The reason for this is a lot of the plastics that we use, say from our clothing, when you wash it in the washing machine, it generates thousands to millions of microfibers per wash. Those fibers go to the wastewater treatment plant. The wastewater treatment plant does a really great job at removing them. Up to 99% of microplastics are removed in these plants, but they're removed into the biosolids. And the biosolids is another word for like treated sludge. In California, we utilize that biosolid as a resource. It's very high in nutrients. Plants love it. And there's a couple farms in California that use very high quantities of it. And so that's really one of the major sinks for plastics, is where a lot of our plastic goes. Some amount is going to make it through the wastewater treatment plant and go out into the environment, into the oceans sometimes. And a lot of the other plastic that we use on a daily basis can also make its way into waterways through rain and being picked up by the air as dust and traveled long distances. One of the greatest pathways for plastics into the marine environment or an aquatic environment is actually what we call stormwater. A high rain event happens and it washes all the particles that are accumulating on our streets into the waterways. Those particles, those plastic particles in the streets, come from our tires. So the tire tread indicator on your car, when you go and you put your thumb on it and you see if it's bald or not, well, all of the mass of your tire that's gone, it didn't just disappear. It's in
our water.
It's in the roads waiting for stormwater or something to wash it into a stream, a lake, a reservoir, the ocean, an estuary. And in some cases, these particles can be extremely toxic to marine life because tires have a lot of chemicals that are quite harmful.
Well, I'm going to hold us there. We're going to go to break real quick. And I want to talk about that marine life, about what's happening. It's happening all over the country, all over the world. But there's one study in San Francisco Bay. And I want to come back to that and have you speak to that real quick. So everyone, hold on. We're going to continue this conversation. We'll be right back. Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows, guests, extended versions, and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Microplastics Are Everywhere. What's the Risk? With host Jessica Aldridge and guest Dr. Scott Coffin, environmental toxicologist and research scientist at California State Water Resources Control Board. We've been talking to Dr. Scott Coffin about microplastics and plastics getting into our environment. We're going to talk about what that means to the human body here in a moment. But you had just mentioned before we went to break about this getting into estuaries, about getting into our waterways. One example, I mean, there's many examples around the country and the world, but one is what's happening to the San Francisco Bay Area. They have a partial estuary up there and other environmental areas. What's happening?
So the San Francisco Bay Area is highly densely populated. There are millions of people that live right around the bay, constantly driving, generating a lot of tire wear particles, as we mentioned earlier. There's many wastewater treatment plants that discharge treated water into the bay. Again, some of those microfibers from our clothes are going to be making it through. And in 2019, researchers from the San Francisco Estuary Institute and the University of Toronto in Canada, as well as the Five Gyres Institute, they partnered and did a monitoring study to look for microplastics in surface waters. They also looked for plastics in fish tissues, a little bit of sediment and wastewater treatment plant effluent and stormwater. They wanted to get a complete picture for how much plastic is there and how is it getting there. And what they found was the vast majority of plastic particles are fibers. Again, likely from our clothing, but other types of particles can be fibers too. I mentioned tire wear particles. Sometimes those can also occur as fibers, but generally they're more rubbery fragments. They also found that stormwater had contributed 300 times higher concentrations to the bay than all of the wastewater treatment plants combined. That was a dramatic and surprising finding, where we had not really considered stormwater to be a relevant pathway for plastics getting into the environment. Really, we had underestimated the contribution of tires to the microplastics issue. And this finding has prompted a lot of research and investigation into stormwater as a potentially important pathway for removing microplastics in places outside of San Francisco Bay, yeah, like Los Angeles and elsewhere.
Anywhere, really.
And so before I mentioned exposure and hazard, and for the San Francisco Bay, the researchers collected quite a bit of information of data on how much microplastics are floating near the surface of the water, particles that could be ingested by fish and other organisms. And they collected pretty reliable data set, if not one of the most reliable data sets that we've ever had. We were able to use this exposure data and compare it to hazard concentrations that we derived based on laboratory toxicity studies for many different organisms. And when we compare the concentration that causes harm to 5% of species, theoretically, to the concentrations that we're seeing in San Francisco Bay right now, there's significant overlap. Approximately 23% of samples exceeded a risk threshold, meaning that a decent portion of the San Francisco Bay may already be at risk for impacts to the aquatic ecosystem there.
That's crazy. Well, another risk that's come out recently is there's been a lot of media around finding microplastics in our food, but recently in our bodies, with a study saying that human breast milk of 26 of 34 samples had plastic polymers in them. What are the main pathways that microplastics are entering not only our environment, as you've talked about, but the human body?
We've been finding recently that air is the most important pathway for microplastics
when we're breathing.
So breathing accounts for the vast majority of the particle, the microplastics that we are exposed to. And This is mostly due to the things that we have inside of our home. Carpets, rugs, clothing, upholstery and furniture, all of that that's made of synthetic microfibers, it's going to shed every time we use it. And often we don't have adequate filtration inside of our home. This is something that can be somewhat resolved by installing a filter inside your house. Fairly easy thing to do. Up to 10% of the dust in your home is actually made of plastic, if you look at it under a microscope.
And food packaging?
So food packaging, if you heat plastic, it's going to release way more microplastics than if you don't heat it in most cases. So there was a recent study looking at tea bags. They found that if you there's a certain type of tea bag. It's really fancy looking. It's made of plastic. Tea bags, if you were to put them in cold water, you would see like tens to hundreds of microplastics come off. It would be a very small number, like per tea bag. But if you put boiling water, you see millions to trillions of microplastics come off. Basically, you're dissolving that tea bag into infinitesimally small particles that can accumulate in your body. And that was a groundbreaking study from a few years ago. It seems like every time we look at food packaging and expose it to heat, we're finding very, very, very high concentrations. One of the most relevant ones is baby bottles. If you put warm milk, the milk itself has some fats that help loosen up the microplastics, the heat. You could be exposing children to very high quantities of microplastics. And we know that this is actually happening because a recent study looked at microplastics in the blood of children and adults, and they found higher concentrations per body weight in children than in adults. So children are getting exposed to higher quantities. They're crawling on the ground, they're breathing plastic from the carpets and rugs all the time, they're chewing on things that are made of plastic, toys and binkies. And it's in all of the plastic food packaging that their food comes in.
And then when you're talking about the food packaging and say you're putting it in a microwave, or it's the packaging that you got, maybe it's foam that you got for your to-go ware, or now they have the paper ones, but it's got that shiny liner in it that could either be plastic or bioplastic, and you stick that in the microwave and cook it. Is that the heat that you're talking about?
Exactly. And it's not just microplastics that you're getting, it's all of the other chemicals.
Chemicals.
I mean, another chemical that is ubiquitous and super harmful, perfluorinated chemicals, or PFAS.
We have a whole show on
Greatest
that.
the greatest exposure route for people is through microwavable popcorn bags. Those things are coated with PFAS and you get crazy high exposures if you eat microwavable popcorn.
Call it popcorn lung. What if you freeze it? Because you extreme temps, right? You're talking about heat, but what if plastic's put into the freezer? Is it the same type of exposure?
That's a great question, and it's really going to depend on the type of plastic. In the case of heat is always going to increase the microplastic shedding from that. But in the case of cold, it really depends on if the polymer is what we call amorphous. Basically, it's not really a solid or a liquid, or if it's fully solid, and also if it's going to fragment in different temperatures. Some plastic you put in your freezer and you bring it out and it's just like completely disintegrates in your hands. Obviously, that is turning into microplastics. You can see it with your naked eye. But other things like a bag, that's an amorphous polymer, and it's not going to be affected as much. You'd have to basically submerge it in liquid nitrogen for it to become relevant.
Really don't have that in my kitchen, unfortunately. One other thing before we get up to fatty and acidic when it comes to packaging, because I want to talk about that for a second. But if you're talking about a tea bag being plastic, the coffee cups, the disposable to-go coffee cups have a plastic liner in them, and they're being poured hot liquid, hot coffee, hot tea. Is that the same concept?
Absolutely. To my knowledge, no one has studied how many microplastics come off of a disposable coffee cup that you might get from a coffee shop, but we can reliably guess that it's going to be a non-negligible amount. And it's interesting that you bring this up, because we have regulations here in California that require state-owned facilities to transition away from non-recyclable materials to either recyclable or compostable food packaging. And this paper-based cup that has a plastic liner inside of it, it's not recyclable and it's not compostable. You cannot separate those two materials, the plastic and the paper. And when it goes into a composting facility, the paper disintegrates from it, and then you're left with this like very small bag, basically, that was like the inside of a cup, and it's not compostable. So the way that the industry is getting around that is they're making that plastic liner, what was once a film, into a coating. They're calling this aqueous dispersion coatings. It is literally microplastics that are sprayed onto the inside of your cup. And they know this is not what they should be doing. The industry is trying desperately to hide this fact. And it's been exposed in Australia. There's been a few organizations that have called it out and have already banned it. But to my knowledge, the European Union, North America really are unaware that this is happening.
So is that happening to the paper cups with the plastic lining? Is that also happening to the ones that they're calling compostable because they're using a bioplastic lining and they have to move away from regrettable substances? So they're not allowed to use the PFAS anymore, but they can't figure out what their grease barrier is. So is that what they're moving to?
100%.
Oh my God.
I couldn't believe it either. Yeah. So right now I'm working with some researchers to obtain some of these materials, subject them to a simulated food stuff, standardized test, look at how many microplastics are coming off of the food stuff. My guess is that it's going to be a pretty high amount, because it's you're spraying on the microplastics and securing it with an aqueous layer, a water-based layer. You're not polymerizing the plastics together. You're not making a film. And they're probably coming off when you're eating and drinking. But even if they're not, even if your direct human exposure is negligible, these materials are going to our composting facilities. And once they get into the composting facilities, the compost is now contaminated with microplastics, but also it's going to get through whatever sort of filter they have, where the composting facility, you know, they have the solids and then they squeeze out the liquids, so to speak. And those liquids, they're going to go right through the particles and the liquids. They're going to pass right through whatever filter is available, because they're already very, very, very small particles. We're talking about less than 10 micrometer particles. These are particles you cannot see with a microscope. It takes sophisticated instrumentation to even detect these particles.
Wow. Okay. Man, my mind is blown right now, and I'm angry, and wow. The acidity and the fatty nature of the food can also affect how the plastic migrates, or how does that work?
Exactly. So higher or lower acidity, so lower pH, is going to aggravate the plastic more than more neutral food. That just has it's simply an interaction with the polymer with the acid enhancing the degradation. Additionally, if you expose it to light, that's going to probably be the biggest instigator of breakdown in addition to heat. And that was part of my PhD, is looking at, well, if we put these plastic products out in the surface water and constantly getting bombarded by UV radiation, is it going to enhance the particle breakdown? And it absolutely does. That's one of the major degradation routes for plastic, oxo degradation through oxidation and UV.
So it happens with fat, and when like peanut butter would be in like a plastic container, the fatty nature of that peanut butter would do sort of the same thing.
Exactly. I mean, plastic sticks to fat and fatty-like things.
Before we go to break here, just a couple more. You talked about tires. What about just the road itself? And also what about like fake grass and artificial turf?
So tires, when you're driving on the road at these high speeds, the tire particles that shed become aggregated with the asphalt, and they make what's called a tire road wear particle. And it's a, you can, when you look at it under a microscope, you, they're it's basically like Play-Doh, is the asphalt, and it's Play-Doh is like the tire particles, this rubbery fragment. It's got like all these little rocks in it, and you can see the asphalt, and that makes the particles very dense. So basically, when they get into a waterway, they're going to rapidly sink. So they're gonna accumulate in the sediment at the bottom of a lake or a stream or reservoir.
And I would assume like artificial turf and fake grass is sort of doing the same thing. Like, would that be breaking apart and getting out into our waterways as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's not been too many studies looking at the generation of microplastics coming from artificial turf, but we know that they do shed and break down. I mean, just go look at an old turf field. There's, you know, places where it's kind of rubbed down. All those particles, they didn't just disappear, you know. And what really surprised me to learn was that artificial turf needs to be replaced like every 10 years.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I don't know how much more sustainable that is than other alternatives. We're short on water in California, but it really is a lot of
yards.
It really is a lot of petroleum to be putting on our fields. And then the end of life, what do? You know, you roll it up at the end and you take it to a landfill.
Yeah.
It's not,
there's no
really,
recycling of
you
that.
You can't recycle it.
You cannot. Okay. So we're going to go to break real quick. We have a lot more to cover, so I'm hoping we're going to get to all of it. And all of you that are super excited about what we're talking about, if we're not able to get to all of it right now, you're just going to have to tune in to our website and go and see the extended version. We'll be right back, and we're going to talk about what this looks like as a risk in our body.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows, guests, extended versions, and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Microplastics Are Everywhere. What's the Risk? With host Jessica Aldridge and guest Dr. Scott Coffin, environmental toxicologist and research scientist at California State Water Resources Control Board.
Dr. Coffin, previous to the break, you were talking about when these microplastics go into our water system, they go to the wastewater treatment plant. The material could potentially get out into the water, but a lot of it's in the sludge. That sludge is then sent sometimes to farms. Can vegetation like fruits and vegetables uptake the plastic from the soil, or does it just negatively affect the crop? What happens?
Quite a few things happen when microplastics get in soil. They affect the microbiome and the rhizosphere, all of the different ways that plants get nutrient from soils. Those can be affected through disruption of the soil physical parameters. It affects the amount of water that the soil can absorb. It can affect the worms that crawl through the soil and help break it up, because those worms are eating the plastic, and it's causing harm to them as well. We recently discovered that plants can uptake microplastics through their roots and distribute them throughout their body or throughout their shoots. We don't know if it makes it into the edible portions of the plant, if it's a fruit or a vegetable, but we do know that, you know, if it's lettuce or something where you're eating the whole plant, you're getting those microplastics. And we also know that at certain concentrations, these plants are not going to be as productive. There was an experiment that exposed tomato plants to higher or increasing levels of microplastics in the soil. And at a certain level, they saw much fewer tomatoes. being produced. So this could have impacts at some point to food security here in California as well as elsewhere.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is this an environmental justice issue?
Absolutely an environmental justice issue. The vast majority of microfibers in California and biosolids are produced from high-income communities, urban communities, Los Angeles area, San Francisco area. And these biosolids are sent inland into the Central Valley, where it's mostly minorities and people of color, disadvantaged communities, and they're contaminating the land of these communities. And so we're not treating the plastics, we're not removing the plastics, we're literally just moving them to places out of sight, out of mind. And this is a real issue because, like I said, these biosolids, they're really great for farmers. Farmers love biosolids. They're loaded with nutrients, and it would really be a shame if we had to lose that resource recovery that we've been doing for decades due to these persistent pollutants that just we can't remove from the waste stream.
I had a friend of mine say that how do we know that that plastics, that the chemicals in the plastics, that there's polymer toxicity existing in the human body? How are we proving that? And is it really having an impact? What would be your response?
As part of Senate Bill 1422, which requires the State Water Board to evaluate the human health effects of microplastics, we conducted a critical review of the literature with an expert panel from around the world. We found 30 studies that had exposed mammals to microplastics in their food or their drinking water. And of those 30 studies, we screened them for quality, and we found that only 12 were considered reliable and useful for risk assessment. Of those 12 studies, 6 of them all reported the same effects to the male reproductive system. We're seeing decreased testosterone, lower sperm count, less fit sperm. And this is happening from different laboratories, different parts of the world, using different particles, different plastic particles. And we're seeing that the size is incredibly important. The smaller you get, the more toxic. And above a certain size, we don't see any toxicity, but we don't see differences in terms of the polymer type. So it seems to be that synthetic particles that our body cannot break down are going to behave in similar ways. There's more nuances like the particle charge and what's happening on what we call the corona of the particle. But by and large, we're seeing similar toxicity from plastic particles to the best model organism for humans at this point, which is rodents, very commonly used. And we don't have enough evidence at this point to say this is definitively happening in humans. But based on the review that we had, it seems quite likely that these effects are occurring in humans at some level of exposure. Again, going back to risk, we don't know what the hazard concentration is. We don't know how much is truly enough to cause harm in humans, and we don't have a great idea for exposure. So there's concern for effects, but we don't know to what extent they're happening in the population.
So it's really looking at this and taking a precautionary principle to say there's a lot of this material out there. We don't know how much a lot is too much before we start seeing negative effects. But the studies you're saying are showing hormone disruption, I would think endocrine disruption, inflammation, like what are the perceived or estimated responses that would be happening within the human body?
So these laboratory studies are using most of the time they're using polystyrene spheres that are completely pristine. They don't have any of those nasty additives that I talked about earlier, like bisphenol A. And so we can effectively rule out the role of these added chemicals, which, again, we know cause additional harm. And it's really the particles themselves that are likely responsible for the toxicity. And this is happening due to what we call oxidative stress. Effectively, oxidative stress is your body's immune response to a foreign object. And for many types of chemicals that we're exposed to, we have evolved over millions of years as biological creatures to detoxify things. And we have very specific, highly tuned mechanisms to do that. But when we're exposed to something novel that we can't digest and we can't detoxify, we resort to very crude mechanisms. We release what's called reactive oxygen species. And these are molecules that, yes, they can break down some agents, some foreign agents, but they can also do a lot of harm to our own bodies. They can cause DNA damage. They can actually react with our own DNA, cause mutations, which can eventually lead to cancer. But most often they cause what's called cytotoxicity, where the cell is simply experiencing experiencing stress, and at some point it can actually kill the cell. With prolonged oxidative stress, you can get inflammation, and inflammation can lead to whatever organ those cells are in not being as functional as it should be.
Autoimmune issues.
Autoimmune issues are related. If someone has autoimmune issues as an existing condition, they're going to be more susceptible to inflammation mm-hmm. and oxidative stress mediated impacts. But it's really a matter of where are the particles accumulating in our bodies and where are they doing the most harm. We know a lot of them are accumulating in the testes in males, at least in rodents, and very small particles we've also found accumulating in the brain. And it really depends on the size and the shape and the charge of the particles.
How can people avoid microplastics? Is that possible? And can we actually flush them out if they are in our bodies?
Our bodies are constantly flushing these particles out. Like I mentioned before, we have evolved these crude mechanisms to break down and remove foreign agents, and our bodies do an okay job of doing that with microplastics. The problem is that we're constantly being exposed, and we're basically living in steady state where we have a lot coming in, we have a lot coming out, but it seems like the amount coming in is higher than the amount coming out. And for if you want to reduce your exposure, I would say that the best things that you can do to reduce your exposure are to use less plastic stuff in your house. Carpets, rugs, synthetic clothing, synthetic upholstery. Just see if you can find alternatives that aren't made of plastic. Even if you do that, you should also invest in an air filter. It's a good idea to have one, especially if you live in California. Smoke season is a thing now. And try to reduce the amount of plastic packaging that you use for food, drinking water bottles and all of our groceries and everything. Try not to heat anything in food, as we mentioned earlier.
Are there certain air filters? And there's also water filters out there. I asked my water filter, which is, I don't know if I'm allowed to say the brand, but it's a big metal container that has two chambers and sits by itself. And it didn't seem that that was something that they knew to filter out.
Most air filters, you know, if they have HEPA filter, HEPA filters are going to do a great job of removing microplastics from the air. For drinking water, I wouldn't at this point advise anyone to spend money on a filter to remove microplastics, because we simply don't know if your exposure through drinking water is relevant for your health. It could be a really small amount in many cases, especially because a lot of the drinking water treatment plants in California are already removing the vast majority of microplastics. Conventional techniques that we've been using to remove other particles and pathogens, turns out they work great for microplastics. Most of these are not going to remove all of them. And that's what we want to find out. And that's why we're doing monitoring in California.
That's why you're doing the studies. And I was going to say too, you had said the fires in California, but there's air quality issues across the United States, across the world. So I think that's a great recommendation for everyone. how do we drive solutions to microplastic pollution? We have what the state of California is doing some things, but like what can everyday citizens do? What can states do?
We have to turn off the tap. That's the number one thing. We have to reduce the amount of plastic that we consume as a society. By 2040, we will be doubling the amount of plastic that we put into the environment relative to today. And today we're already dumping a garbage truck worth of plastic into the ocean every minute. And so, you know, double that by 2040. If we were to focus on recycling alone, which as most people know, we're really bad at for plastic, but if we were just to increase the recycling rates and make that our main goal, we'd only cut the amount of plastic that we put into the environment by 10% by 2040. That's still an increase from what it is today. But if we also reduce, we can focus on reduction targets. We can reduce the amount of plastic by 30% more. If we additionally focus on waste management, preventing plastic leakage into the environment, we can reduce even more. And so this is really a yes and approach, where we should be thinking about solutions that we can do right now, as well as those in the future, both from a policy level and a personal level. At the personal level, you can reduce the amount of single-use plastics that you buy when you go grocery shopping. Remember to use your reusable bag. And for your next clothing shop, consider going to a used clothing store first. Most garments in the United States, clothing garments, are used three times on average, and then they are either discarded into a landfill or they go into the reuse market. And the reuse market is great, but a lot of the clothing that goes to those markets, they actually never get bought again in the US. They're often shipped overseas, or they make it to a landfill because we just have people are buying too much new clothing. We need to be recycling our clothing.
Can clothing also be made, innovated in a way that it sheds less?
Absolutely. So California recently had a challenge through the Conservation X Labs for innovation in this space for textile manufacturers that could innovate ways to reduce the amount of microfibers that shed when you wear your clothes and wash them and put them in the dryer. In addition to reducing shedding from the synthetic clothes that we all love that perform really well, you can also buy non-synthetic clothing. Clothing that's made of hemp and cotton and wool and other materials that are theoretically renewable and compostable.
Well, we have a couple more questions before we end the show, but a reminder to everyone to go to our extended version, and you can find the extended version of this conversation at our website, ecojusticeradio.org. Dr. Coffin, you have a project called the Plastiverse. Did I say that right? Can you tell us what it offers and why it's important?
There's so many researchers in the world working on plastic pollution. Many of these researchers are developing databases, maps, tools, information that is really useful to other researchers. And there's no clearinghouse. There's no Google of plastic pollution tools. They're really just scattered in publications and websites all over the out there. And so I created a website that is a single repository, living crowdsourced repository for anything related to plastic pollution. And I'm quite promiscuous with that definition because I want to get it all. I would rather have it all in here in the website and be accessible than set firm boundaries, because this is really a global contamination problem and a global effort. And we need to think equitably in terms of distributing this information and these tools.
And the last question for you before we go to break, before people go and check out the extended version at Eco Justice Radio, where can people find more information on microplastics? I mean, we just talked about the plastic verse, and follow you, what you're doing, and what the State Water Board is doing.
In addition to the Plastiverse, there is quite a few journals out there that are focused on microplastics. I'm the editor for Frontiers in Water, which is an open a gold open access journal. Anyone in the world can access it for free. We just released two special issues on microplastics. One of them was about bio-based alternatives and are they actually a sustainable replacement for plastics? The other special issue was focused on the human health impacts of microplastics and occurrence in drinking water. So go check those out. Also the journal Microplastics and Nanoplastics, the name of the journal. Also gold open access, free to everyone. We just published about 15 articles in there about the human and ecological impacts of microplastics.
Oh gosh, I know what I'm doing this weekend. Oh, thank you so much. It has been wonderful. I am looking forward to continuing this conversation. We've got about like four or five more questions I want to pick your brain on. And I just really appreciate you being on the show. I really appreciate the work that you are doing and bringing light to this. I just don't think a lot of people know what's happening and how this material is entering our environment and in our bodies. So thank you.
It's been great chatting with you. And I'm grateful that I can use this platform to spread awareness about this important issue.
Thank you. And again, everyone, reminder to our audience, if you want to keep listening to this conversation, go to our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and you'll have more information there on how to get the extended version. Thank you, Dr. Coffin.
Thank you, Jessica.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of the show or to explore other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Microplastics Are Everywhere. What's the Risk? Thank you to our guest, Dr. Scott Coffin, and thank you always to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio SoCal 350 and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.